Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema. Who are these guys?
Welcome, rockers, to an especially glamorous episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
.com. .guyliner.
I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce. He is definitely one of the many drummers for the Wild Rats, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going, sir?
It's going great. I am so excited. This episode has been a long time coming. I've been talking to you about this movie for a couple years.
You just would not shut up about this movie, so I had to give in at some point.
That is correct.
I had to relent. But speaking of giving in and just finally throwing caution to the wind, if you want to go back and listen to our back catalog, you can do so on Blog Talk Radio. You can also do so on iTunes and Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the podcast...
I mean, you like the podcast like Ben Kenobi likes fucking Batman.
And we got a minute in. I was wondering how far we would make it before the first of that reference came up, because it's going to be a running theme in this episode. But yes, all of that. You can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and for as little as a dollar an episode, you get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. And if you want to contribute at the Lieutenant of Megaforce level, that is $25 an episode for 4 episodes, you actually get to tell us what to do, what the subject of an episode is going to be. And we have done that for a solid month now, patron requests. So we're going to take a short break from the patron requests. So if your movie has not been featured yet, don't worry, we are definitely going to cover it. But we wanted to take a little sidebar, if you will, into a bit of programming that parallels something we did last year.
Last February.
Yes.
Last February, we had Gals Who Rock, and I've been wanting to do Guys Who Rock since then. And we just have been overrun with so many other great options.
Yes.
Like we've just, it's been one of those things where we keep coming up with ideas that are so good that Guys Who Rock keeps getting pushed back. And I finally put my foot down and said, hey, maybe we do this next. Yeah, sure. Whatever. Let's do it. So we whatevered right into it, and we are rocking it with Guys Who Rock.
Put his foot down in a gorgeous platform boot,
Oh, yes.
I must point out. Yes, Guys Who Rock, this is going to be pretty much all Cargill programming, because this is not necessarily a genre that I am terribly familiar with. Actually, kind of much like Gals Who Rock was mostly Cargill programmed, because it was a lot of movies that I had never seen before.
I like rock and roll movies. I like movies that merge music with the film in a way that matters, in a way that's not just, hey, let's play a pop song for a montage, but let's actually create some kind of art where we're fusing this. And stories about fame and rock and roll go hand in hand, you know, with film. Like, there's just so much to fame and excess that leads to such self-destruction, and self-destructive narratives are fantastic, but also narratives that allow you to show how people find themselves, as this movie does. This movie kind of covers the gamut. I mean, it really goes from the drunken excess to the drug abuse to the discovering yourself, to people ultimately finding themselves, to people showing who they really are. Like, this movie is such a weird, wonderful piece of art. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those films that, when it came out, was derided for being pompous and pretentious. Mm-hmm. And then loved by another set. Like, this was one of those indie darlings. It was a punk rock film of its own, where it was being passed around. I was working in an underground video store at the time, I Love Video, when it came out. And it was just that film that everybody was buzzing about, but the mainstream was very poo-pooing. And it's a film that stuck with me, and it's a film I've watched couple dozen times over the years. It's a soundtrack that I've listened to I don't know how many times. And we're going to finally dive into this one. I am so happy that we're doing this. I'm so happy you dug it. We actually watched it together.
Yeah, no, for the second recording session in a row, we've actually got to sit down and watch the movie together. And boy, were there some moments where I was like, maybe this is not the movie that you watch with one of your, your male friends.
Were you confused, Brian?
Or just giggling like a schoolboy every time we mentioned the fact that Obi-Wan fucks Batman.
Because, by the way, if you haven't figured it out yet, in this movie, Obi-Wan Kenobi totally fucks Batman.
That will be the drinking game of this episode, is every time we make mention of that, go ahead and have yourself a swig.
Well, it's just, you know, we've gotten to a point where so many great actors have played superheroes or you know, geek icons.
Sure.
That now, you know, people reference, oh, hey, it's the movie where this hero and this hero get together and do this with that villain. And it's like, yeah, well, this is the movie where you get to say Obi-Wan Kenobi fucks Batman.
And if that concept offends you, I highly recommend not revisiting Less Than Zero. Just saying, guys. But the movie we're talking about today,
Iron Man, no!
No! The movie we're going to kick off, Guys Who Rock, is, in fact, 1998's Velvet Goldmine.
Brian Slade was the wildest rock star to come out of London.
The biggest thing since sliced Beatles.
But that wasn't enough.
We set out to change the world.
What happened? Who did it? And why?
Next week is the anniversary of the whole shooting incident.
One journalist is about to look into the mystery.
I was trying to contact you about a story.
From the moment Brian Slade stepped into our lives, nothing would ever be the same.
He was, in the end, like nothing he appeared.
Right after everything crashed, would Brian seem to get lost in the lie? Became someone else.
Miramax Films invites you to throw away your expectations and take a magical trip back to the 70s. When the glam scene rocked London. And the outrageous fashions, music, and behavior shocked the world.
I knew I should create a sensation.
This is actually directed by, I just realized today, a director whose name I know, whose films I have never seen.
Oh, I love Todd Haynes. This is the movie that is least like anything else. Like, the closest thing comes to, he actually references himself in this movie. In 1988, he made a cult film, and it was a cult film you could not find anywhere. Again, at I Love Video, we had a bootleg of it. It's called Superstar, and the Karen Carpenter story, in which he tells the
character. Oh, he directed that.
He directed that. It's a Karen Carpenter story told with Barbies, and as the movie keeps going on, he keeps shaving down the Barbie to get thinner and thinner. It's one of the darkest, sickest things of that era, but it's also brilliant. Like, the guy who did Velvet Goldmine had done this crazy weird video project that became this weird cult film that we passed around in the 90s, and this is, a lot of his other stuff have been more historical films. They all tend to deal with sex and sexuality. Mm-hmm. You know, Todd Haynes talks about his homosexuality quite a bit in his films, and this film is really great in that it is about it. Not only is it dealing with glam rock and homosexuality and bisexuality in the press, but it's a film about the sexual awakening of one of its fans.
Yeah.
And the film is framed in a examination of this guy going, played by Christian Bale. He is set by his job as a journalist to go back and do some research and find out what happened to this legendary glam rock icon, Brian Slade.
Named
David Bowie. We'll get there. In order to kind of piece together a where are they now thing, as Toni Collette says in the movie, a jog your memory piece.
Yeah.
And what it does, though, is it not only forces him to re-examine everything that happened and learn the inside story of how the glam rock scene actually happened, but it also causes him to go back and reflect upon what the glam rock scene meant to him and how it created him as an individual and how he found himself and found his own peace and happiness.
Yeah.
That by the end of the film, like when we first meet this character, he is this nerdy, weird kid who doesn't really connect with anyone else. And when he starts to find himself and come out of his shell through this music, he starts to gain confidence and ultimately become who he is. And who he is not an echo of this. It's not an imitation of the scene, but that scene helped him find himself. And there's so much profound truth in that arc, in how we connect with art and how art allows us to help define ourselves. It's what I really connect with in this movie and I think is fascinating. But like you brought up, the movie started out as a biopic about Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
And then Todd Haynes went off in a wild direction. Bowie did not like the direction he was going at all.
Bowie did not like the fact that what Todd Haynes wanted to base a chunk of this movie on were a couple of unauthorized biographies of David Bowie, one of which was written by Bowie's ex-wife. So right from the get-go, the foundation of the movie was going to be dubious, to say the least, or under a lot of scrutiny, and it offended Bowie to the point that he threatened to sue the production, so they had to go in a different direction and create this character of Brian Slade, played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, who is, of course, history's sexiest king of England, as we all are aware.
Well, this is true.
And so, yes, Brian Slade, at the beginning of the... I want to say this right off the bat. I get why people found this movie pretentious. Pretension is one of the things that will shut me down against a movie so fucking quickly. Like, I am definitely somebody that the minute something feels... Like, there's a reason that I can't fucking stand the French New Wave and have never had anyone be able to change my mind about that. I can't fucking stand pretension. I get it. And when this movie opens with a spaceship visiting Oscar Wilde as a baby, I get where you're coming from with your accusations of pretension.
Or is the spaceship dropping off Oscar Wilde?
Okay. Either way. You know what? Fair point.
I would argue that that's one of the least pretentious things in this movie.
I'm just saying, when that's the starting point, I can get why people are like, I don't know if this is a movie for me. But so much of this film is actually based around the life and works of Oscar Wilde. A lot of the dialogue in the movie comes directly from his works, and there's a reason for that. The thing is, and this is one of the few random things that I know about classic literature, is that Oscar Wilde, in addition to being somebody who very much was a fan of puns and double meaning and irony and satire, and so the kind of humor that is definitely something that I love, was a homosexual, and living in a time where being a homosexual was illegal, there's a pretty famous case in which a writer accused him of being a homosexual, and he sued in court for libel and lost the case, which led to his incarceration, because since the case was proven that the person that wrote he was gay wasn't false, it was then found out that he was gay. So I think the reason that there is so much of a basis in Oscar Wilde's work in this movie is very much the parable of somebody like Oscar Wilde, where hiding who you are can be so self-destructive, and it's in a very literal sense when it comes to Oscar Wilde, that I get why the movie starts there. But if you're coming into this cold without that ridiculous AP English knowledge that has stuck around in my brain for I don't know what reason, I get it. I get why you're looking at this going, what the fuck am I even watching?
Well, it is that it's one of the brilliant things that Todd Haynes does in this is that he likens the career of David Bowie to Oscar Wilde, yeah, and talks about that, and then goes on to show what happened in what I think was great about Bowie, you know, leaving the project and threatening to sue, was that what it forced him to do is to tell the story of glam rock in parable form.
Yes.
And to use big moments in glam rock and instead create them as these more mythic moments.
Yeah.
So like, you know, the movie opens up talking about the faked assassination of this character, Maxwell Demon, which is the alternate persona of Brian Slade, yeah, which, of course, is Ziggy Stardust.
Yeah.
But what that was really about is that's really about the night that that David Bowie and or Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders of Mars played their last show together, in which the band didn't know it was their last show together. The David Bowie had not told the band that they were breaking up, and they have they've recorded the session. You can listen to it online or you can get the album. It's one of those great live shows. In fact, there is a 15-minute track on it that is so blistering that is one of the greatest live concert tracks of all time. And the show is just amazing. You're like, holy God, this band, this is such a great moment in time. And then at the end of the concert, David Bowie just says, thank you all very much. That was the last show from us ever. And dissolves the band on stage without the band even fucking knowing. And so,
which I suspect is how you will end this podcast at some point. You'll just, we'll be about to hit the button on GarageBand to close the session. And you're like, well, that was the last episode. Good night.
I'm not saying it's this episode,
but I'm also not finishing that sentence.
Sure,
sure, sure, sure, sure, sure.
I'm not saying it's this episode. I'm not saying that in so many words. But yeah, so for Haynes to then go and take that iconic moment, which was the death of glam rock, you know, this was Bowie saying, yeah, it's over. You know, I've done everything I wanted to do. And to have that as being a career suicide, is a really interesting take on that. And then, of course, the rest of the metaphor of Brian Slade seems to be Todd Haynes' impression of Bowie's career, which is not flattering.
No.
Because, you know, Bowie had a very weird career after that. Like, he was the superstar and then went on and did albums, but he kept reinventing himself. And in reinventing himself, that's what the ultimate final moment of this character is having reinvented himself again as this 80s icon. And it's such a fascinating way to go about it. The structure is... I marvel at the structure because it's all over the fucking map, but in a way that makes sense, where it is, he's impressionistically going, it's a Rashomon style story in which you've got this character going around and getting everybody's little bits and pieces. And while we're getting everyone's little bits and pieces, we're getting the recollections of the interviewer of being there at the time that those bits and pieces happen. And then finally, the last bit of story that we really get to see is his version of the events, where he ties in, where the things that he was at that were big pivotal moments, and then his big pivotal moment of his one night with a rock star. Yeah. And it is... So, you know, we joke about it, and I love it because it's one of those fun things to joke about. But the sequence of him making love with Kurt Wilde that whole night on the roof is so fucking romantic and beautiful, and then ultimately tragic in how this final scene kind of plays out, that it is it just, this movie hits me where I live, and it's just so, it just, I love the depth of character that we see scattered throughout what could easily be looked at as a music video of a movie. Like, it's 2 hours of music occasionally punctuated with dialogue.
Yeah. Well, I honestly think that Bowie turning on the project and it having to take that different direction is the best thing that could have happened to the project, because even though this is 98 and it wouldn't really become so stock and trade until after the 2000s, there is such a formula to music biopics. There are two ways you can basically go with a music biopic. You can completely deify the artist. You can make a movie that makes them seem like God on Earth.
Yes.
Or you can do the movie that highlights their demons and focuses so much on those demons. And I feel like when it becomes so methodically churned out, like almost machine-like, it undercuts the uniqueness of the artists that are being featured when you can literally paint by numbers a story about their life. And this movie, Velvet Goldmine, does such a great job of creating a completely different approach to covering the life of a singularly unique individual. And I think that would not have been the case if it was a straightforward Bowie biopic. I feel like it's one of those necessity being the mother of invention kind of things when you're forced to have to revamp your entire approach and you come up with something as interesting as what Haynes does in Velvet Goldmine.
I love that it was actually Jake Kasdan that kind of killed the one you were talking about, the non-deific telling of that story. For those of you that have never seen Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story.
Yes.
Like I can't watch any of these old biopics anymore because they all have the, you don't want any of this, Dewey. Why? Is it an addictive drug? No, it's the least addictive substance in the world, but you don't want no part of it. Well, I guess it'll ruin. No, no. Like the laying out of the drug story.
It's always somebody. There's such a weird, like, and you know what I blame all of this on is A Star Is Fucking Born. Because A Star Is Born became the boilerplate for how you make tragic rise and fall stories in the music industry, to the point that literally every artist who gets involved with drugs is like a fucking babe in the woods and has to be tempted into it by somebody else. I'm like, maybe they just made the fucking decision on their own to try drugs. Like, why do we have to pretend that every artist that we've ever seen a movie about that has ever had a problem with drug addiction is forced into it by somebody else? And they're just like, oh, gee, golly, I don't know if I should do that. Like, what fucking time period are you living in?
No, I love that. And I love that even though that's part of this story here, that's not part of the downfall of this story. Like, for one character, they're already past that.
Yeah.
Like, one character's like, you know, that great scene where, you know, Kurt Wilde says, you know, heroin used to be my main man, but now I'm on the methadone, so maybe now you can be my main man. Like, he's already past his drug problems. And then the drugs that we see are all just kind of party-based. Like, there's this, you know, I think the great downfall of Brian Slade and as a character, what's so fascinating about him is the moment where he and his wife are dissolving their marriage.
Oh, my God. There has never been a more glam rock biopic thing that I have ever seen in anything than throwing the divorce papers in a pile of cocaine.
Throwing it in the pile of cocaine so he won't forget them.
Yes.
So he won't lose them because he'll always know where the cocaine is. But there where, you know, she just says, haven't you wanted anything more than this? And he just goes, no.
I'm just surprised that scene isn't in A Futile and Stupid Gesture. Like, if they ever, like, went into one of Chevy Chase's divorces, I feel like that's what would have happened. Like, it was such a singular moment of, like, oh, I get everything that is where all of these characters are right now is summed up by the image of the divorce papers covered in cocaine.
But that whole scene where, you know, he doesn't want anything more than this. All he's ever wanted is to be famous. All he's ever wanted is to be that mythic rock star. And then she says the most cutting thing to him. You live in mortal fear of not being misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, and of course he keeps quote. And of course, as you talked about, he's quoting
Oscar Wilde
so many times during that sequence and over the course of the movie. And it's such a fascinating character concept to show the hollowness of that desire that all of us have at some point. Like, it's funny. There's this story of Kate Winslet reportedly keeps her Oscar in her bathroom so that people, when they go to the bathroom at her house, can have an Oscar speech in front of the mirror, because we've all done that. Like, at some point in time, if you're a movie fan, you've stood in front of the mirror and given your Oscar speech. And so she has that there so people can actually have that moment with it. And I find it really interesting that this thing that at some point everybody kind of wants to be a rock star. Like, that's you imagine it, even if that's not what you really want. Everybody kind of imagines himself on stage, 20,000 screaming fans, you know, and this guy has it and he's totally happy with it. And it's all he's wanted. And that there's nothing more to him, that he is just who he's become as a person is just a reflection of what he thinks will sell. And I think that's a really, really interesting way to do that kind of a story and go, oh no, he got everything he wanted, but what he wanted isn't what we really identify with. Like, he's hollow. He's artificial. He's just flash.
Which feels like the most scathing indictment of David Bowie in the entire movie.
Sure.
And it's, you know, like, you're never going to convince me that David Bowie wasn't great. Like, there's no amount of any type of filmmaking that's going to convince me that David Bowie wasn't a genius, wasn't groundbreaking, wasn't incredible. But I am fascinated by the sort of circuitous way that Haynes finds to tell a different side of that story and at least present a different perspective.
Well, I think what's amazing about what Todd Haynes does is he agrees with everything you just said, except that he just adds a yeah, but.
Yeah.
And the yeah, and this movie is the yeah, but that. Sure. And I don't think it's just an indictment of Bowie. Like, that's the thing, is this Bowie is the model here, but it's an indictment of the entire industry. It's an indictment of the creation of image and glamour and selling that and what it, you know, what it is doing to the culture, but also at the same time, what it means to people. Like, that's the thing, is, you know, as much as you could say that this movie is an indictment of Bowie, it's also showing the effect that Bowie had on Todd Haynes, you know, and Todd Haynes is, of course, you know, his avatar in this movie is played by
Christian Bale,
as the journalist. And here's this journalist in the 80s coming to grips with this turbulent time of his in the early 70s and his sexual awakening, and how his small role playing in this small side story. And that very much feels like what Todd Haynes is doing in this movie, is as much as he's being critical of his heroes, he's also talking about how his heroes made him grow and turn him into who he is. And I think he references that visually here. There's a moment where you joked about it looked like Fellini threw up in here.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's an accident. I think that's absolutely what he's doing, is he's talking about his own worship of Fellini and the filmmaking and how that helped awaken him. The fact that you refer, there's a Jess Franco reference in here.
Yeah, the fact that the band is called Venus and Furs. I was like, okay, so Todd Haynes is a big fan of Jess Franco, because that is a film that I feel like a lot of people probably haven't seen, and I'm not necessarily saying that that's a bad thing. I'm not the biggest Jess Franco fan.
There's a reason why we haven't covered Franco out here.
No,
he's interesting. I don't know that there's a Jess Franco film that I love.
Yeah, no, I...
But I admire the craft.
Oh, sure. Yeah. At this point, I think there are more Dave Franco movies that I love than Jess Franco movies. So put that on a fucking t-shirt and crucify me if you must. I will say, there is something, and maybe I am way off the mark because I am a heteronormative, boring white guy. So this is my just coming in from the outside and trying to think about this in those terms. But there's something interesting about the idea of glam rock presented as a gateway for sexual awakening, because there is a certain amount of anonymity in androgyny, and so much of glam rock is about blurring those gender lines and being able to just be a persona in irrespective of gender. And I think that's really interesting that you have a character who is coming to grips with who they are sexually by launching into, you know, and showing how the culture of England was changing with these glam rock acts, and how that kind of gave all of these guys an outlet to be themselves and kind of and disappear into. There's a great moment in the movie, which I think, again, is probably where people are pointing and going pretentious, but I kind of got where Haynes is coming from, is a scene of, like, it's almost like a dream sequence of a three-ring circus, a press conference rag, if you will, where Brian Slade is being interviewed and he's asked a question about basically his sexuality and who he is. And he quotes Oscar Wilde and says, a man is never more false than when he's himself. If you give him a mask, he'll speak the truth. And to me, it was like, well, that's what glam rock represents to Todd Haynes, was a way to put on a persona that exemplifies your personal truth in so much as you're able to disappear into that persona.
It's interesting too. One of the other things, one of the undercurrents, is they keep referring to, you know, President Reynolds. And of course that's President Reagan, because we're living in an alternate reality and they set it up as an alternate reality. But so it's interesting, because what you need to know in terms of gay history is that from glam rock into disco, there was a big sexual awakening in this country where, for a brief moment, it felt as if homosexuality was going to be normalized and be accepted, and people were coming out, and it was, you know, it became a part of the popular culture for a brief instant. And then there was the big pushback against disco and the famous death of disco, which we've talked about on the show a couple of times. And
fucking steamrollers at Shea Stadium, baby.
And on top of that, you have, you know, Morning in America, the rebirth of conservatism as Reagan-era conservatism, which we've watched mutate over 40 years and become something else. But so what happened was we went had this brief moment where it felt like we, you know, there was going to be a freedom in the community, and then it was snuffed out. And we had this ultra-conservative anti-sex 80s that led into the 90s and the ennui of the 90s that finally we started seeing the dam burst, and we started actually seeing the 20-year fight that would lead to where we are now, to where we totally have an open society and we're trying to squash out the last little bits of homophobia in it. But so to people like Todd Haynes, in the, you know, here he made this film in 98 where, you know, we Ellen had just come out. Mm-hmm. There had just been the first male-male kiss on American television. It was, you know, we had yet to, I mean, at this point, when this movie was made and released, it was still illegal in Texas for two men to have sex with each other. It was, it wasn't until 2003 that the sodomy laws were struck down by the Supreme Court. And in fact, oddly enough, Justice Scalia wrote in his dissent that this would lead to an argument for gay marriage. And everyone told him he was crazy because this country would never allow gay marriage. Mm. And it would, you know, 12 years later, we would finally, you know, get that win in the Supreme Court that he would vote against. beautiful irony. That man could not have died in a better way. So
could have died sooner. That's all I'm going
to
say.
It's a quick trip to the sidebar. I'm actually a fan of early Scalia on the court.
Okay. I'm sorry. You said that the way that people, it's so apropos to this discussion that people say that about, like, I'm a big fan of the early Stooges stuff before they went real mainstream.
Yeah, no. No,
early. I'm a fan of early Scalia.
Well, look, and nobody's going to do this. I know no one listening to this is going to do this, but if you read early dissents by Scalia or decisions by Scalia, he was a really, really interesting jurist who believed in the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law. He was somebody that was about, he was very much about freedom. He was very much about expression. He was very much about trying to prevent government overreach into our lives. And then as he got older, his religion and his conservatism took over, and that old Scalia got squashed out whenever it came to politics. Whatever was good for the Republican Party and whatever was good with the Catholic Church, particularly the American branch of the Catholic Church, became who Scalia was. And so he kind of, all that old freedom-loving Scalia kind of got squeezed out into the Scalia that we all know now as somebody who fought very hard against gay rights and who ultimately, thankfully, lost, but who was the conservative that you could set your watch to him just based upon politics. You'd be like, oh, hey, this is the current trend in the Republican Party, so this is how Scalia is going to come down. So yeah, I went from being a very longtime Scalia fan to being a very anti-Scalia person myself. But end of the sidebar.
End of sidebar.
No longer the legal sidebar.
Yeah, and I apologize to the one guy on iTunes that always tells us we talk about politics too much, even though I think we've mentioned politics once or twice in the last
year. That might be too much. And my opinions on Scalia may be unfavorable to the crowd here. But you know what? That's sometimes I talk about bullshit, and that's why I have a podcast.
There you go. And I also think it's apropos to mention Reagan and the fact that they keep saying President Reynolds and not using his name. I mean, Reagan, people don't forget. This is very well known, but people don't like to talk about the fact that Ronald and Nancy Reagan ignored AIDS for so long as a political maneuver and in like the most unfortunate and frightening way to just pretend that it didn't really exist.
One of their close friends, Rock Hudson, was diagnosed with AIDS, and they cut him out of their life.
Yeah.
Like, he was somebody, these are two people who came up as actors in Hollywood. who hung out on that scene, and these were their friends. And yeah, they, when he was diagnosed, she, Nancy Reagan famously snubbed him. It's one of the things Hillary got dinged for when she gave a, you know, eulogized Nancy Reagan when she passed away and said she was such a big fighter for, you know, bringing, notoriety to AIDS, and everyone was like, no, that was Princess Diana. That was, she was the first famous person to shake someone's hand without a glove when they had AIDS. That's who you're thinking of. Nancy Reagan was not that person. Nancy Reagan was the person who didn't like drugs. So, and that's what's so interesting about what Haynes is doing with this Reynolds thing, because we have this character, Brian Slade, who is an out bisexual, loves drugs, loves excess, is all about the party scene. And then ultimately by the end of the movie becomes this clean cut dude, who is asked at a event back, you know, after the concert, what do you think of the work President Reynolds is doing? Oh, I love the work President Reynolds is doing. It's, the big shift to becoming mainstream, becoming, you know, more outwardly conservative to keep that star, because that's where 1984 was. And that's one of the things I just really, really love about this movie is Todd Haynes is saying so much about the culture and where music went and how politics became infused and the death of this dream that was glam rock. And I just absolutely love how he does it. It's one of those movies that, having watched it dozens of times, I'm still always picking it apart and finding little bits and pieces that I didn't realize meant something else. This movie, it's my favorite film of Haynes. It might be his best film. I know Far From Heaven was the one that got all the Oscar nods, and Far From Heaven is a great film. Carol is a really great film. David Ehrlich will die on the hill of saying that Carol is one of the greatest films ever made. But it is, this is the film that really speaks to me and I feel has the most to say, because it's just so dense in what he's doing.
And speaking of someone with something to say, I feel like at this point we should probably bring up Roger Ebert.
Let's bring Ebert into the conversation.
He gave it,
Roger. Okay, thank you for that.
Sadly, Roger is not here to defend himself, so I will try hard not to just dunk on this. But he.
Well, first, start off with how you got this little piece of information. We have a wonderful crew of guys.
Yeah, we have a great research team here that puts together sheets for me that have a lot of the trivia and just kind of the ins and outs of the movie, so that I can come at this forearmed. And our one of our researchers actually, when he submitted the sheet on this movie, right underneath it, he made a comment and he said, you know, I like Roger Ebert, but fuck Roger Ebert, because this movie is awesome. And just like was so excited to have seen it and was very incensed by Ebert's 2-star review. But I want to read a little snippet of it because I think it speaks to something in the structure of this movie that fascinates me. And he says, Citizen Kane may have just been voted the greatest of all American films, which it is. But how many people watching Velvet Goldmine will appreciate a scene where a former Slade partner is seen in a wheelchair just like Joseph Cotten? And this movie does feel like it's referencing a number of different things. We mentioned Fellini.
Oh, yeah.
There's absolutely Citizen Kane references.
Sure.
However, I think Ebert misses the mark by not referring to the Joseph Cotten film that structurally this more resembles, which is one of my favorite films of all time, The Third Man. Because Christian Bale, throughout this movie, is looking for someone who used to be a part of his life, someone who, throughout the entire movie, turns out to be hiding in plain sight. Like, and it's a very, if you watch this movie from the context of it being a glam rock Third Man, is fucking incredible. I absolutely love like that entire, like going through and solving this. Cause that's the thing, is Christian Bale's character is not some reporter assigned to this project who then kind of falls into it and the intrigue washes over him as he gets deep. He knows a lot of what's going on because he was there. So many of the formative moments of his life have revolved around the person he's now tasked with investigating. So it's not a dispassionate investigation. He has a lot of personal stake in finding these answers. And I think that's what keeps this from feeling... That's what gives this movie heart, I think, is that you have a character like Christian Bale who is so invested in finding these answers, not because it was assigned to him, not because it's his job, but because so much of his life has revolved around the rise and reinvention of Brian Slade. So the fact that he is really desperately trying to find this person who is not wanting to be found and has actually gone to great lengths to conceal himself to nefarious means, it's pretty outstanding. It really changes the whole scope of this movie, and I think makes it even more brilliant.
Yeah, no, this is really, it's one of those films, it's several different types of films woven together and told in such a masterful way. There is no movie like it. It's one of the things I find so fascinating. It's a movie that I love to watch in multiple ways. Like, there's not a lot of movies like that. Like, there's times where I just want to sit down and watch it stone cold sober, like I did with you today. And then there's times where, you know, I'm up late at night and I kind of just want to zone out to a music video. And it's like, here's 2 hours of just impressionistic filmmaking and such a, what we have not really talked about, such an amazing fucking soundtrack.
This soundtrack is next level. It absolutely, between this movie and the one we're going to talk about next week, you could compile an amazing playlist that would last you pretty much all day. Of just the songs from the soundtracks.
Of just glam rock style music.
Yeah.
So let's break down the super group that's kind of put together for Venus and Ferb.
We have a Traveling Wilburys situation here. A super group.
Yes. Well, I mean, it really is. Like, for the person who put together and supervised the music.
By the way, ask your parents.
So many of the songs in this soundtrack are covers, mm-hmm. and then there's others that aren't. And it's very hard to tell the difference unless you really know the music that it's all based on. There's a couple that you're like, everybody knows Satellite of Love. And like, there was a moment where you sat up and you're like, wait, I know this song. It's like, yeah, it's 20th Century Boy by T-Rex, I think. So Tom York put this together from Radiohead. He put together a supergroup with Johnny Greenwood, who was also in Radiohead. Then the David Gray Band's Clune, Suede's Bernard Butler, and Roxy Music's Andy McKay. And,
Jesus.
And they together played a lot of the music in this. All of the Maxwell Demon stuff is either written by York and that band, or were covers of music from this era. Kurt Wilde's band, the Rats, are the Stooges, Ron Ashton, Sonic Youth, Thurston Moore, and Steve Shelley, Minutemen's Mike Watts, Gumball's Don Fleming, and Mark Arm of Mudhoney. Like, this is all of these people on the cutting edges of 90s music, covering this music that meant something to them and doing such an incredible job with it that even if you hate this movie, I cannot understand hating this soundtrack.
There's a fictional band in this movie called The Flaming Creatures, and it's the band Placebo playing that group. So yes. Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting real life musicians that have come together to kind of fill in the background of this movie.
Yeah, and doing such a great job of it. And it's amazing because it doesn't sound like any of their stuff. They really are. You can tell there's this passionate, nerdy love of this music that is makes it so precise, and even the music that is fictional for this movie feels like it came out of that era. And I've listened to this album and the soundtrack of this movie so many more times than I've listened to some of that music that this is, to me, part of the language of glam rock. Mm-hmm. It is, if you started playing any one of these songs on the radio, it'd be like, oh, I love this song. Oh, where do I know this from? Right. It's the Venus and Furs.
Yeah.
It really connects with me. It's just something I absolutely love. But some of these covers, like the cover of 20th Century Boy, is fucking great.
It's phenomenal.
And the Satellite of Love in this is really good. Lou Reed be damned. I love Lou Reed, but the Satellite of Love is really great. And it's just, it all, this movie is in itself a love letter to that era as much as it is using it as an expose of the dangers of fame and obsession with fame. Because ultimately, I feel like as much as it's criticizing Bowie, it's criticizing Oscar Wilde while it's also talking about his genius. Like, that's what's so great is this movie is unflinching in its praise, if you will. Like, it does both at once. It's the backhanded compliment, but it's more compliment than backhanded. Mm-hmm. So it's really an interesting thing that is all its own.
And I want to talk a little bit about the sci-fi elements of this movie.
Okay.
Because as I mentioned, the movie first of all, it opens with what sounds like Cate Blanchett and leftover stuff from the first Lord of the Rings movies. Because it's like...
Histories, like ancient ruins, are the fictions of empires.
Much that once was is lost, for none now live who remember it.
While everything forgotten hangs in dark dreams of the past.
Wait, what's going on? Are orcs about to attack? What is happening right
2,500 now? 2,500 years ago.
Yeah, it's just like, I'm sorry, what? Like, when the Age of Man ended? I'm confused. But then a fucking spaceship shows up and may or may not be delivering Oscar Wilde to this planet.
So for any of you who are like, why is Velvet Goldmine on Junk Food Cinema? Let's just start with the fact that it opens up with a monologue and a UFO delivering Oscar Wilde. And just go from there.
Yeah, and then there appears to be a Highlander-esque immortal storyline about this piece of this pin that every one of these guys gets passed to them that, again, may or may not have mystical powers that allows them to live forever.
But
unclear.
Well, not living forever, but what it seems to be is the possessor of that goes on to become someone great and goes on to greatness and achieve greatness. So, you know, Oscar Wilde had it. It, you know, ended up in the dirt at the school where Jack Ferry, you know, the original icon of that ultimately is said everyone ripped off. I know that's based on a real person, but I'm not 100% sure who it's based on. But that, you know, Jack Ferry has it, and Jack Ferry gives it to Brian Slade, and Brian Slade becomes huge, and Brian Slade hands it to...
Jack Ferry does not give it to Brian Slade. Brian Slade steals it from Jack Ferry. This is what becomes really intriguing about this pin, is that it becomes a sort of like Highlander MacGuffin of the source of all the power, and when you have it, you are the most powerful person in the world of this movie, and Brian Slade straight up steals it.
That's true.
And it's pretty like, again, you could view this entire thing in the context of a fantasy film, and it doesn't lose a single step
In fact, it's one of the things I love about it is, like, it's because, again, it's also a statement. As much as you could look at it as a literal fantasy element, that there is this magical thing being passed along, creating fame and granting pop success to all of these people that are the holders of it. At the same time, it's a really great metaphor. It's a really great concept for, we instill this power into these things, and we instill this power into these people that they are somehow larger than life, when really they're just people, and they're people with desires and talent, and we exalt them into this magical thing that they are not.
Yeah, and the thing is, we're talking about a spaceship delivering Oscar Wilde to this planet. It sounds like it should be the kind of thing that has us going, the fuck is even happening right now? But honestly, considering the fact that this is a roundabout way biopic of David Bowie, an artist whose uniqueness makes him feel like he is not from this world, and in fact influenced the whole, he is a rock star from Mars, and like that entire persona.
When he passed away, so many people said, David Bowie's not dead, he just went back to Mars.
Yeah.
Because that's that, yeah. And so I've always felt that that was wonderful. It's also at the same time a great way of saying, hey, by the way, this is a rock and roll fairy tale. Like, this is not a biopic.
Right, exactly.
This is very much, we're telling a fairy tale. It's set in an alternate reality, and it is a delightfully weird alternate reality, but it is one in which we, you know, have these rock stars that are analogous to, you know, Kurt Wilde is Iggy Pop, but he's also a little bit of
Mick Jagger
from the Rolling Stones, because there's a famous story about Bowie's wife walking in on Mick Jagger and David Bowie naked in the same bed.
And then they turned that into the video for Dancing in the Street.
Yeah, that's a video that happened.
there was nothing we could do to stop
it. There were there was a time in the 80s Bowie had become a coffee achiever.
Much like the Reagans and
AIDS. I am a coffee achiever. I don't know. Do you know the coffee achiever campaign?
I have no. I thought you were speaking about something you order at Starbucks. I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Sidebar.
You are the new American society, the movers and the shakers. Hold on tight to your dream. You are the new coffee generation.
Because coffee lets you calm yourself down and picks you up. Coffee gives you the serenity to dream it and the vitality to do it. No other drink does that like coffee. Hold on tight
to your dream. Join the coffee achievers.
Do your best.
So for those of you at home, Cargill just showed me, be a coffee achiever.
I am a coffee achiever. I am the coffee generation. Coffee helps you think. It gives you quiet moments.
Here's what I kept thinking about while watching that happen. I kept thinking that there, somewhere in an advertising agency is a Don Draper who is like, I have an idea for how to make coffee mainstream. Go with me on this. And lays out this campaign of all the movers and shakers of the world.
Which is, frankly, pretty impressive.
If you use the term mover and shaker, you are neither of those things. So let's retire mover and shaker immediately.
They were my favorite members of Salt and Pepper.
You pushed that joke real good.
I'm sorry. So the coffee achiever commercials were David Bowie, Kurt Vonnegut,
Hart,
Cecily Tyson.
Cecily, can we just talk about how it was you? It gives you the energy to really meet the challenges of your day. And the whole time she's rehearsing a scene where she slaps some guy, and it's like, coffee, you'll get slapped. What? I don't understand.
It was the 80s. It was a different time. You didn't understand coffee. Starbucks was not a thing. You did not know. In fact, it's funny because you looked at me and you're like, so they're just advertising coffee. Like as if it's coffee. And it's like, oh yeah, because like coffee was a thing, but coffee was not the thing it is now, where it is such a mainstay that somebody saying, oh yeah, no, I was late to work. Why? Well, I stopped to get coffee and the line was long. Oh, okay. I get that. We've all been there. That was not a thing in the 80s. You did not go out to that. Like when you said coffee shop in the 80s, you meant someplace like Jim's.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the 90s that we started seeing indie coffee shops show up and cups got ginormous for a short period of time.
Hello.
Hello.
Ask your parents.
And then, of course, you know, Starbucks started moving in everywhere. Wait, hold on a second.
Old man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
Way overdue.
Yeah.
So, way overdue in this
way
episode.
Way overdue on that one. So... I mean, I did a Scalia sidebar, for fuck's sake.
That you did. And you also used the term, it was the 80s, it was a different time. Which I feel like you only get to say like 5 or 6 more times as a catch-all for, look, it was weird, okay?
It was really weird. We were all coffee achievers. But I find it fascinating. The reason why I wanted to reference this is, look at Bowie on that screen. That Bowie in this commercial is Tommy Stone.
Yeah.
Like, he is no longer, you know, from Mars. He is
from the suburbs,
wearing perfectly coiffed hair. Like, the Tommy Stone in this movie is so pointing out the iteration of who David Bowie had come. And the whole concept, the third man concept you talked about hiding in plain sight, was he wasn't the David Bowie that people had fallen in love with. It is that little shot of, no, this is the David Bowie that sold out. This is that David Bowie. This is not the Bowie who would then come back into cool again in the 90s. Like, David Bowie was, since we're on an old man Cargill, let's just do
as
it.
As we are. Yeah.
David Bowie became very mainstream in the 80s. He was a rock god in the 70s, and the 80s became very mainstream. And then by the late 80s, early 90s, he wasn't cool anymore. In fact, my wife didn't grow up with Bowie music, and I ended up introducing her to a lot of Bowie. But then he would do something really fucking cool, and in 96 and 97, he would go on the road with Nine Inch Nails. And he would have Trent Reznor produce an album for him. And he did this really great cool fucking album in the 90s in which his song, those of you that are familiar with it, I'm Afraid of Americans, came from, which Trent Reznor's in the video for that. And he went on tour, and Nine Inch Nails would not let Bowie open for them. So they would open for Bowie. So it created this very weird dichotomy where you had Nine Inch Nails and David Bowie playing a tour, and two-thirds of the audience would leave after Nine Inch Nails went off stage because they didn't care about this old guy. And the third that would stay around would watch a fucking David Bowie concert, and then the second half of the David Bowie concert would be Trent Reznor coming out, and Trent Reznor and David Bowie fucking performing together. It was fucking amazing. And they did a really cool video about the tour. And I'll never forget this moment in which David Bowie was talking to Trent Reznor. He's like, I just don't get, you know, modern rock and roll is very different from my time. You know, you're like, God is dead. And in my time, I would have been crucified for saying, God isn't all that in a bag of chips. and it was such an interesting thing to see someone who pushed those barriers at that time, so humbled by someone pushing the barriers 20 years later and doing something that he wasn't able to really conceive of and needed to go to try to keep up with rock and roll. And of course, in the 90s, going, you couldn't do better than going to Trent fucking Reznor.
I feel like the struggle should have been, you guys, your rock is God is dead. In my day, I was God. Like, Bowie was at least a god at the time.
No, that was the thing, was, but at the same time, you see Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails, just like, you know, the touring band, just like, they're like, oh my God, we're touring with Bowie.
Yeah.
And Bowie's just like, I'm happy to be here. It's such an amazing moment in history of, you know, the mutual rock of, and so from that point on, then it was cool for my generation to really be into Bowie again, where all of a sudden it's like, yeah, no, Bowie's cool. Bowie gets Reznor, and Bowie gets where rock and roll is. And he's not an old timey touring band. He's someone who's still trying to figure rock out. Which is why then Bowie would go on to become the ultimate legend that he was. Like, the guy reinvented himself so many times. He has names for his various characters.
Yeah.
And so, but I do find it interesting that Tommy Stone is kind of throwing shade at the one era of him that wasn't his greatest era.
Sure. And that is definitely kind of an interesting turn that the movie takes. And I want to talk for just a moment before we wrap up about a couple of the performances.
We haven't even really gone through the amazing fucking cast here.
We've mentioned here and there.
We mentioned Jonathan Rhys-Meyers.
We mentioned Christian Bale, and we mentioned Ewan McGregor, who is playing Kurt Wilde, who by the end of the movie, by the way, maybe this is just me reading, maybe it wasn't the intention, but really feels like Kurt Cobain. By the end of this movie,
he really
feels like Kurt Cobain.
I feel that's very much where they were going with that. I mean, keep in mind, when this movie was made, the death of Kurt Cobain was still fresh. It was still just a few years past. And Kurt Cobain was, you know, cut out of the mold of, he wanted to be Iggy Pop. Like, that is very much who he wanted to be. So I feel like Ewan McGregor was definitely fusing Iggy Pop with Kurt Cobain.
And I feel like that works really well. But I want to talk about Toni Collette in this movie.
Holy God, is she good in this movie.
I don't understand how, if nothing else, even, you know, it seems like in America, because I was looking at some of the box office numbers, and it seems like this movie was a huge miss in America, which makes sense, because it's really talking about a movement that wasn't the same here as it was in England. But how she didn't at least get some attention come award season for this performance, I legitimately don't know.
And in the year that it was released, it is a notoriously bad year for cinema. This movie came out in 98. Mm-hmm. And 98 was a year so bad we just gave almost all of the awards to
Saving Private Ryan, wasn't it?
No? I thought
it was Saving Private Ryan in 98 that just fucking cleaned up.
Saving Private Ryan did a lot, but it was also Shakespeare in Love.
Oh, you're right.
We were just giving everything to Shakespeare in Love. Elizabeth had come out that same year, which Cate Blanchett had exploded on the scene.
For none now live who remember it.
And then there was Rushmore, and that was pretty much it. Like, those films are great. But that it was mostly a wasteland. So to be in a wasteland like that and not have gotten Toni Collette in there for best supporting, is kind of nuts.
Yeah, her performance in this, she really goes on, I think, the biggest journey of the movie, from being this sort of freewheeling party girl to the wife of Brian Slade, who is completely implicit in his entire extravagant, indulgent lifestyle and, you know, getting some for herself, to someone who just gets fed up with it, to someone who kind of feels cast aside, to someone, you know, by the time she's interviewing with Christian Bale, who just feels so broken by the entire experience in a heartbreaking way that, for me, when people talk about this being a pretentious movie, I'm like, I can't agree with that, if no other reason than the performance of Toni Collette.
Well, and the thing is what I love about her is not only her performance, but the brilliance of the subtleties of it and the parallel, because she's a American who went to London and put on a fake British accent to become a big party girl there and live the high life and rode it all the way to the top. And then was like, oh, well, I wanted something more than this. What do you mean more than this? This is what we always talked about. This is what we dreamed of. Mm-hmm. And she just kind of goes back, and she's still performing at this sad little bar in what looks like New York City, and has lost the British accent. Like, she's gone back to be, in fact, the thing is when she gets into that big argument with him, she totally loses the accent in mm-hmm. the midst of it. And the points at which she goes back to her American accent aren't accidental. Like, it's deliberate, because she is somebody who is all fake on the outside and then gets fed up with that lifestyle. And it's such a great turn, and it's such a great performance from someone who is one of our greatest living actors. And I think it's about time I think people are finally coming around to, oh, wait, Toni Collette is still here, and she's been in a litany of some of the greatest movies ever made.
This year, there is an outrage at the fact that she did not get nominated for Hereditary.
Because it was a horror movie, and we don't nominate horror movies.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, she is so much an actress that we still respect and admire, and is doing so much good work to this day, that literally, as we're recording this, the arguments are still going on as to why she should have been nominated this year for Hereditary.
Yeah. But she's great here. And then, of course, let's get it. We haven't mentioned it yet. Eddie Izzard.
It doesn't really matter much what a man does with his life. What matters is the legend that grows up around him.
Eddie Izzard in this movie, hilariously, this is a movie filled with androgyny and men dressing up as women every fucking where.
And he's the most masculine part of the movie, to the point that he wins the contract
by arm wrestling.
By threatening to arm wrestle.
It's like a fucking, like, it's like they're arguing for Sinatra's contract. It's so ridiculous. He's like, I will tell you how I plan to make Brian Slade a star
when you pin me.
And it's just like, you have to.
And it's a mic drop. Like, everyone in the room is like, fuck.
Guys, Eddie Izzard is the only man in this movie not in drag. I don't know. I don't know what to do with that. Like,
that's information that's kind of hard to process.
I cannot wrap my head around that. If you're not familiar with Eddie Izzard, he is an actor and a stand-up comedian, and the whole crux of his persona as a stand-up comedian is that he is himself a crossdresser, a transvestite, and is completely open about it, and does most of his stand-up sets in drag, and talks about being a transvestite. So to see him in a movie full of androgyny, full of men dressing as much like women as they can, and he's the only one not in drag, is mind-blowing to me.
I know, and I think it's a deliberate choice.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that's what I think. I think, in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if they decided, hey, let's butch this up even more, because he could not be butchier and more flamboyant. He looks more like a pimp
than
anything else at times. But who is he? Do you know? Did you recognize the person he stole the contract from?
I did not.
That is Stephen Feast. Or Michael Feast, rather. Yeah. Not Stephen. Michael Feast. Aeon Greyjoy.
Oh, you are shitting me. Yeah, Aeon, I did not recognize
Greyjoy,
him at all.
Is the one who originally, like, I mean, God, the cast in this thing is just kind of insane.
It really is.
And it's insane to me that this movie is not considered a bigger film, is not as beloved. I tweeted about it several months ago. And all the usual crowd that I'd expect to come in and go, fuck yeah, we need to talk more about that movie. We're kind of like, dude, move along with this one. That movie doesn't hold up like you think it does. And I'm like, fuck you, it does.
I actually think it does. And I think the things that people have pointed at and said, that's really self-indulgent, that's really pretentious, really speak to the fact that very much like Bowie, this is a singular film experience that is so unique that you're not going to find anything to really compare to it. And I feel like that's the greatest triumph, is that it manages to be a film deserving of somebody like David Bowie, because it is completely of its own ilk. There's nothing I could point to and say this. I mean, I will say it's a great double feature with next week's movie, but not because the movies themselves are alike, but there are themes that get tackled in both movies very, very differently, but in a way that I very much appreciate. But this film is very much unique, and is very much that thing that we chase a lot of times. As much as we like our conventions, as much as we like our tropes, every once in a while, you just want to sit down and have a singular film experience, and that's exactly what Velvet Goldmine is.
I think the thing about the film is it feels so thin. Mm-hmm. It feels so empty. It feels so hollow, and it is, in fact, dense. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very dense. Like, as we've talked about, I mean, it's referencing, it's dropping Oscar Wilde quotes, it's referencing famous films, it's, you know, referencing directors, all without ever mentioning them. Like, right. That's the thing. I feel that maybe, and I hate to do this because I don't want to be that pretentious guy, but maybe some people just aren't catching all the stuff that's in there and putting it together. They're just not liking what it is on its own and dismissing it for being, very cotton candy, if you will.
Yeah, and I won't go so far as to say the thing that I absolutely hate when people say to me is maybe some people didn't get it, because you want to make an enemy of me real quick? Tell me a movie I didn't like. Well, you just didn't get it, because I will not speak to you again. Like, fuck off.
I have a friend right now who's Will Goss, who's very upset because he did not like Bohemian Rhapsody, and keeps talking to people, and everyone goes, well, see, I'm a big Queen fan. And he's like,
go fuck yourself. Are you like, fucking
I'm a
serious?
Big Queen fan. Don't do that.
Okay, I can be a Queen fan and a fan of good editing at the same time. I'm just going to throw that out there. I'm sorry. I'm not going to get on a fucking horse about Bohemian Rhapsody.
Which we'll be covering next week.
No, we won't. No, we won't.
In our month dedicated to Bryan Singer.
Nope. None of this is true. None of this is happening. I just want to go ahead and squash that right near.
Followed up by Valkyrie.
I will say... Jesus Christ. American actors pretending to be Germans, pretending to be British. It's anywho, I will say that it just maybe didn't resonate with people. Like, I can absolutely see a very high barrier to entry with this movie. And I completely get that. And I think that it would have been entirely possible if it didn't just click. Like, and again, if I hadn't known as what I know about Oscar Wilde, I probably would have been in the same camp. With people going, well, that's just fucking, like, hoity-toity, self-indulgent pretension. And it's like, no, there's actually a very specific reason why they chose Oscar Wilde. And again, if I just hadn't have fucking retained that in one AP English class, I might be in the same boat. But it did resonate with me because of that. It's like, I get what he's going for, and I love the packaging that this story is delivered with.
However, I cannot dismiss it is self-indulgent. It is self-indulgent as fuck. It's just self-indulgent in the way that it's indulging me too.
And if there are two guys that are going to appreciate something being self-indulgent, it's the hosts of Junk Food Cinema.
That is correct.
Let's be real with ourselves for just a second.
I'm down, Benjamin!
And that brings us to the Junk Food Pairing, and I hope you're sitting down. I hope you got your mugs ready, coffee achievers. Because have yourself a big steaming cup of Joe as you watch Velvet Goldmine, and remember that you are the movers and the shakers of this world.
Hold on tight to your dream.
Or do it like I did. I watched it with coffee over ice, because this is a movie that can go both ways.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, we didn't mention the great performance, by the way, the supporting performance by Ewan McGregor's dick.
Oh.
Who definitely makes an appearance in this film.
Oh, well, it made an appearance in a lot of films in the era. In fact, at the time when he was interviewed about he was interviewed about that while he was prepping for the release of episode one. And someone asked about that. And, you know, what do you think about fans that will go back and discover your previous work? And Ewan McGregor got out of him that it was the nudity, because he was nude in several films. And he goes, well, I mean, I really tried to keep that going. I've done a number of films in a row where I've been completely nude. And I mean, come on, what kid doesn't want to see Obi-Wan Kenobi's lightsaber? And he just turned into that skid. The thing is, you mentioned the appearance by his Wang. It's not just an appearance. The motherfucker dances. Like, the thing shows up and says, hi, I'm on screen for a little bit, dancing.
It got SAG credit, I'm pretty sure.
It got its SAG card out of that.
It definitely got its SAG card.
That was the third movie that it showed up in.
I think that at that point.
I love the idea that Ewan McGregor's Wang has a SAG card now because it's appeared in so many movies.
I think if they had elected for him to show his dick in The Phantom Menace, they would have had to change the title from episode one to episode 6.5. But I don't know that for
sure. Well, I mean, I know I showed it on a projector, but
all I'm saying is
you were measuring.
It was longer than the trade negotiations. That's
are some pretty long trade negotiations.
I'm just saying, guys,
put the nitro back in the box.
Back in the box. Move it with your mind. Put the midichlorians back in the box. This is the end of the first episode of Guys Who Rock, and I can't imagine a better send-off for Velvet Goldmine than what the fuck just happened. So if you would like to hear more of that kind of shit, you can always find our back catalog on Blog Talk Radio, as well as on iTunes, as well as on Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean, you like the show like Obi-Wan Kenobi likes fucking Batman.
You can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and you know the rest. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
With Batman in a tub on a roof.
It's only, I'll tell you this.
That's scene, my favorite solution to Clue ever.
That scene is only the third or fourth weirdest thing that Batman has done on a rooftop. So
also true.
You know.
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at MassaWyrm, MassaWyrm. And you can find my other podcast with Dave Chen, in which I give 10 to 20 minutes of writing advice on Write Along.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury, and of course at Twitter... at Junk Food Cinema. And I guess we can, I mean, they announced it already, so I guess we can go ahead and say that we will be doing a live podcast at Chattanooga Film Fest.
I'm going to Chattanooga, third year, baby.
Pardon me, boy. Is that Junk Food Cinema at Chattanooga Film Fest? Track 29. Oh, yes. I'm super excited.
Oh, yeah. No. First of all, those of you who have thought about going to a film festival in the past, this is a great starter fest. It's like what Fantastic Fest was in the early days. Not only will you get to see us there, but there will be a number of films that are on the circuit that everyone, you know, all your favorite horror bloggers will be talking about. Lots of great genre stuff there. Joe Bob Briggs does a lecture there every year. Last year he did Everything is Genre Part 1, which got into the early 60s. Now this is ostensibly Part 2, which is going to take us from the 60s on through the present day. So if you've never gotten to see Joe Bob live, this is your chance. Chattanooga is the place to do it. And if you like standing around drinking whiskey, talking to filmmakers and film lovers, Chattanooga is the place to do it.
So we're going to be in the same company as Joe Bob Briggs, Everything is Terrible, and Shockwaves podcast. Like, that's... I am honored that Junk Food Cinema gets to be in that category. That is the weekend of April 12th through the 14th. So if you're in or around the area, I highly recommend going to Chattanooga Film Fest, where we will be. But that's going to do it for this week. So until next week, let's briefly mention the movie we're going to be covering next week.
Still Crazy. One of my favorites from the 90s, from the era when every British comedy was the next Full Monty.
Yes.
This is the film that I hold dear to my heart, and I owned on VHS and have watched a lot. If you guys kick back, it's on Prime right now. Kick back tonight and watch it. Enjoy the fuck out of it and come back next week and we'll talk about it.
And remember to always, always be a coffee achiever. Hold on tight to your dreams.